of a Victorianist. Are we talking about some sort of earlier text and some later text? But that's my period of expertise. And I did do my DPhil here at Somerville, finished it quite recently. So I've taken my title here from one of the standout items in the exhibition, and that is Benjamin Keach's The Child's Delight, or Instructions for Children and Youth. And I wanted to read the title in full because it's one of those marvellous, descriptive, early titles that gives you a real sense of... It sort of gives you a sense of, it doesn't just sort of hint at what the book's going to be, it gives you a real elaboration of everything that it contains. The Child's Delight, or Instructions for Children and Youth, wherein all the chief principles of the Christian religion are clearly, though briefly, opened. So, just the small tasks here with this promise. Necessary to establish young people in God's truth in opposition to error in these perilous times, together with many other things both pleasant and useful. For the Christian education of youth, with letters to parents, adorned with several copper cuts, teaching to spell, read, and cast accounts, with a short dictionary, interpreting hard words and names, likewise a form for a band, bill, or receipt, and a table showing the interest of any sums and co, fit for the use of schools, and useful for all families. So it's like the kind of, breathless miniature advertisement, the large claims that children's books right from the start of their history kind of make for themselves, for the transformative effect that they can have on those who buy them, because I suppose the commercial aspect of it is important too. So I think that Keach's work is of interest for a number of reasons. First of all, as you can learn, the exhibition has a kind of scandalous history. I believe that the first 1,500 copies of a previous version of the text were all burned. There's not one, but five, called schismatic and heretical by the Anglican minister who sort of got hold of them. So Keach was arrested, imprisoned, pilloried, and then fined for writing the work. And he's actually forced them, which I think is quite extraordinary, considering all of the stuff that's in it, to rewrite it from memory sometime later. I don't think we know how close it is to the original, obviously, but quite the feat. So this rewritten version that we see here, The Child's Delight, the first one was called The Child's Instructor, it's a big success, as we can see from the fact that it's in its third edition, the copy that's in the exhibition. And I suppose I want to flag out that little backstory because we might have an, I think, erroneous assumption that children's literature sort of excluded from the controversial questions of its time. Here we see a children's book right at the centre of sort of political and religious debate. But second, I like that phrase, many other things both pleasant and useful, because it evokes all of these sorts of promises that children's books make to their readers, things that unite sort of delight, so that's quite a key word of children's literature, with sort of usefulness, utility, education. So I'd like to put Keach's many other things both pleasant and useful alongside another figure from the exhibition, so that's John Newbery. And the frontispiece to many editions of the early children's book published by Newbery called A Little Pretty Pocketbook, they have this statement, instruction with delight, either in English or in Latin. And I suppose I think that it's quite important to remember that dual purpose, even when we're considering what might seem to be quite didactic works for children from this early period. So in a wonderful book that some of you may recall, Be Merry and Wise, by Brian Alderson and Felix Merez de Oyen, they point out that we might think that the sorts of things that early children's literature, or early kind of evangelical children's literature is about, so awe and contrition are kind of big topics, wickedness and repentance, they might seem sort of joyless to us today, but actually it's this radical moment when books start to address children for the first time, when start to consider sort of children as being perhaps worth writing to specifically. And I think that's true across the works that are shown in the exhibition, so we could also think about Hannah Neal's Sacred History, so a translation of the Old Testament into a form that will be accessible or enjoyable to children, the author assumes, so the dialogue. But finally, though, I used Keach as the title for the talk because that really various set of things that are contained in The Child's Delight, I think that they pick up a number of characteristic threads in the history of children's literature. So we might think about teaching the alphabet, about addresses to parents as well as to children, and of course illustrations as well, so it's an illustrative work. These are all important to this new market of children's literature that's sort of getting going in the 17th and 18th centuries. So, inspired by that mix of material, I'm going to give you a kind of grab bag, I hope, today, of different trends from the history of children's literature. My themes, I'm going to have four themes, the first of which is going to be alphabet books. Reward, prize, and gift books will be the second one. The third one, what I'm going to call children's writing, so that's things like the children's magazines, so books that children have actually written themselves, but also children's marginalia, a little bit. And then finally, I'm going to talk a bit at the end about illustration and about pictures more concertedly. So it's sort of think about a few trends rather than exhaustively discussing just one. So as I said, I'm going to start with the alphabet book. I'm not sure whether you would have seen this page from Keach's Child's Delight. It's the first page after the title there. So you'll see we've got each letter of the alphabet, including the long or medial S and excluding J, which is not kind of widely added yet. We've got the alphabet in a variety of scripts. So English, which I think means black letter, as well as Roman and Italic. And what happens after these letters have been given is that the lessons that the child's being taught kind of expand out. So the next pages look like this. We have a syllabarium with syllables that you could form using the letters. And then we kind of build up to a list of complex polysyllabic vocabulary in the page at right there. I don't know if you can sort of read the words particularly well, but quite a sort of delightfully specific and complicated vocabulary that the child's being taught there. So we have archbishopric, ecclesiastical, and badger's skins, which I believe is from Exodus, although I also understand perhaps that badger might be perhaps a mistranslation there. But so you sort of see this, my point exposes really, that we're having this build-up from the tiny little parts of the language, those first acts of learning language, to quite complicated lessons. And then we also progress to more sustained pieces of writing, so poems, letters, short pieces of prose. And it's also more, obviously more sustained acts of reading that the child's going to be able to perform as they progress through this book. So this kind of staggered approach to trying to teach children how to read, which is adopted by Keach, it's one that's prevalent in sort of alphabet books and primers from the 16th century onwards, so even before such texts are aimed at children. So it sets up the alphabet sort of in relation to both sound and meaning really quickly. And so I thought I'd show you a couple of the sort of precursors of this. So that's horn books. So contrary to the name, they're not actually a book, they're a sort of paddle on which the alphabet and sometimes other things, so like the Lord's Prayer would often be on them. They're sort of included to teach the child how to read. You can carry it with you. Some of them have holes at the bottom so you can sling it on your belt and presumably do a bit of quick revision on the run. And the name horn book comes from the fact that they're kind of overlaid with a very thin sheet of horn to protect them, really. So this is another kind of trend that we could pick up. Children's books don't last. There's that kind of defacement or sort of loss of them that results from them being read so much. But what I suppose my point is that Keach's book is kind of picking up on these sorts of things, putting the alphabet in context right away. And I also put this cartoon here, which is sort of speculating on the uses of the horn book that are not perhaps strictly condoned by it. So the idea that you might smack a child who didn't learn quickly enough with it. The second feature I thought that, you know, is interesting to think about this teaching of the alphabet. So Keach's Child's Delight contains pictures, almost, I think, sort of quite modern-looking pictures, really, in the sort of grid-like structure there. So the pictures, what they do is they kind of have a series of sort of catechistical statements or questions. So at the top there, the patientist man, Job, and at the bottom, Daniel in the lion's den. So teaching these lessons about characters, personages in the Bible, biblical figures. So the sense that information's being conveyed not just through language but also through pictures. So that's another kind of important thing. And a real sense, I think, of the diverseness of the content, all the different things. You heard the list of, you know, a bill of accounts as well as the alphabet. So Keach doesn't actually give these pictures with letters, but obviously that is also a really big trend in children's literature that I thought I'd talk to you a little bit about now. So what's often thought of as the first picture book for children. There's an alphabet book, at least in part, 17th century nursery book used to teach children Latin and English or another vernacular language. So it's Comenius's Orbis Sensualium Pictus. So there were, you know, they're kind of immensely reproduced works. The Patricia Cairns of like 244 editions between 1658 and 1964. And this page that I've given you here, it's from an English edition, the early 18th century. And we have at the we have a list of letters, and we also have phrases in English and Latin, and then pictures that go with them. So cornix cornacatur, the crow crieth, is the one at the top. So I'd say what Comenius is doing is a bit different to Keach. So he's using the letters to kind of start a little miniature story, an illustrated story at that. And this, of course, is a trend that all of you will be familiar with from alphabet books later in the 19th century up to the present. So I just thought that selection here as well. So from one of Edward Lear's nonsense alphabets, conveniently for everyone, I think, there is a drawing of Lear's from one of his nonsense alphabets in the Great British Drawings exhibition at the Ashmolean at the moment. But so C was a lovely pussycat, its eyes were large and pale, and on its back it had some stripes and several on its tail. So that's Lear's little short rhyme for C. Walter Crane also has a cat, it's the cat that played the fiddle in the nursery rhyme. And then at the bottom there, sort of from earlier in the period, a quite unusual children's alphabet by the writer Barbara Hofland. So I don't know if you can see, but the capital C, it's not the cuckoo, which is discussed, it's that sort of cherubs forming the shapes of the letters, like a kind of a contorted cherub there. And the verse says, C is for cuckoo, a fine pretty bird, but it has but one note and cries only one word, nor builds a warm nest as other birds do, but spends all the morning in saying cuckoo. So obviously, tiny, tiny story, moral embedded right away in it. And I suppose I take you back here to Keach, this clear sense that we get from the vocabulary that he's offering children, the way that he's teaching them to read, that there's this specific things that he thinks children should know. It's kind of moral and didactic, even though it seems like it's perhaps a kind of value-neutral text, perhaps an alphabet. But I suppose I want to say as well that I think that all of these more playful alphabets from later, they're just assertion about particular things a child should know. It's just that they kind of think that think different things are important. So things like being playful, perhaps, or sort of being industrious, but not in a kind of religious sense. So I'm going to move on to the second sort of set of examples that I want to talk about. And that is in relation to an item in the exhibition called the Child's Reward Book. It's published around 1820. So as you can see from the image, it's an illustrated volume containing a number of different stories, including Early Piety by the Independent Minister George Birler, Shipwreck, and the History of Thomas Brown. But what I think the title picks up on is a major trend in children's literature at the time it's published, and that's producing books as rewards or prizes. And the publisher of this example is actually the Religious Tract Society, I believe. So this is the kind of publisher that's really involved in producing these examples. So the society is founded in 1799. It has this purpose of, quote, publishing those grand doctrinal and practical truths which have in every age been mighty through God in converting, sanctifying, and comforting souls. Initially, there's not a really pronounced distinction between tracts that are aimed at adults and tracts that are aimed at children. But as the 19th century progresses, the Religious Tract Society becomes one of the biggest publishers of books for children. And not just books, I suppose, but also magazines and tracts that are specifically aimed at children. And, of course, the Society is actually sort of associated with lots of big figures in children's literature, so people like Sarah Trimmer and Hester Stretton. So that kind of intertwining of religious instruction with the very kind of beginnings of children's literature. So lots of the books published by the Religious Tract Society were specifically intended for Sunday school prizes. So in that way, I suppose they are books given on a particular occasion to mark particular achievements. So they're kind of occasional books in a way, and often the way that we can tell that a book is a reward book, it doesn't tell us in the title, as this example does, is we can look at gift plates and we can look at gift bindings. And in fact, I thought I'd give you sort of someone commenting on what sorts of books were good to give as prizes. So Charlotte Mary Young writes, in the 1880s when the gift book market's kind of really, really big and developed. There's very little call for improving books in the lending library in proportion to those meant for recreation, but I would urge that they be used for prizes. At present, the usual habit is to choose gay outsides and pretty pictures with little heed to the contents, but it should be remembered that the lent book is ephemeral, read in a week and passed on, while the prize remains, is exhibited to relatives and friends, is read over and over, becomes a resource in illness, and forms part of the possession to be handed on to the next generation. The reason that I think this quotation is interesting to think about is because it sort of shows the ways in which production and purchasing of children's books will be linked afterward to the context in which they're read. So she's imagining lots of scenarios for children's reading. So reading in bed when you're sick, showing your book off to your siblings, reading as a kind of social activity, which I like because it's against our perhaps conception of reading as solitary, individual, isolated, you know, we just read by ourselves perhaps. I wanted to show you a couple of other examples from the Religious Tract Society's gift books from later in the century, so later than the Child's Reward book. One of the most successful series was called the Little Dot series. The prize books, starting in the 1870s, they have a very set format, so sort of 64 pages with lots of different stories and a coloured frontispiece. I'll show you some of the coloured illustrations in a minute. Later on, as kind of the market for prize books developed, they also have lots of colour illustrations too. And I think comparing this item, the Child's Reward book, sort of about that big, that's very, very small, these are sort of larger volumes, you can see a development, I think, just from the covers or the physical appearance of these books, a development in the kind of idea of how you might market books to children and market books as prizes. I'd have to say the sort of bright colour of these covers and of some of the illustrations is in perhaps sharp contrast to the contents of the stories, which are a little bit hair-raising. So I don't know if you can see here what Little Dot's doing. She's on one side sort of dropping daisies into an open grave, and on the other side kind of adorning the grave with flowers. So she goes and is sort of reflecting on the early deaths of all of these largely children who come to the... the kind of little coffins that come into the grave. And I'd have to say, it doesn't end well for Little Dot. And she too occupies a grave, and the last image in the story is kind of her gravestone with the prayer that she has industriously learnt during life, etched on it for all eternity. So I think this story harks back actually to earlier kind of texts of religious instruction for children, such as Janeway's infamous Token for Children from 1671. It has this kind of very barnstorming preface where he addresses parents and says, "Your children are not too little to die, not too little to go to hell, not too little to serve their great master, not too little to go to heaven." So sort of some positive news there as well as the negative, I suppose. So there's this clear link between childhood and kind of death, the idea that you have to prepare children for death in children's books. Now, I thought after all of that doom, gloom, and kind of perhaps even maudlin content, we might look at a kind of related genre of book in the period, which is the gift book. So the gift book kind of takes up some features of the reward book, but it's often got secular or sort of not as instructional or not as religious texts. So it's got these lovely covers and presentations, and sometimes, you know, publishers producing fine editions to present to children. So on the left there, that's Louisa May Alcott's Good Wives, as one part of Wardenlock's Lily series of gift books. And I thought actually both of these titles really, they point us to another trend that I think we can see in some of the books on display here today, and that's the way in which children's literature is a very kind of gendered market. So that books for boys, books for girls is a trend right away. So the example that I was thinking of here is Mrs. Hewlett's Eliza Harding, which has this very kind of specific set of morals aimed at girls, and a review at the time sort of remarked, "As an antidote to the too prevalent taste for theatrical entertainments, novel reading, confidences from which parents are excluded, romantic attachments, manoeuvring, mysteries, and clandestine adventures, we ardently recommend this little book to parents, especially parents of daughters." So these books, in a different way, I think, kind of address a female audience, a girl readership. Bizarrely, sort of to return to the slide, the copy of Sense and Sensibility on the right there in this beautiful gift binding was kind of given out as a prize to children who consumed lots of sunlight soap in the 1890s. So you sort of send in your soap wrappers and you get this gorgeous reward, I suppose, for washing, maybe, which is this copy of Sense and Sensibility. And then, of course, there's books for the Christmas market. So I just want to show you, this is one of the books that I looked at in my Defield thesis from the Opie collection. It's an Edwardian Christmas book. So a book released sort of in November or December for parents to buy who are looking, you know, they perhaps know that books are a good thing to buy. Children, not quite sure what to buy, they might buy this one. And actually, there's sort of a tab there, and if you pull it, the pictures change. So it's this kind of range of Christmas scenes and motifs that we get given in the book. And again, I think that gift books and reward books, they kind of remind us about social context for reading. And I suppose this is particularly true for children's books, which have adults involved at every stage. So adults writing them, publishing them, reviewing them, and then buying them for the most part. As a counterpoint to that, the next part of what I'm going to talk about is actually about children's writing. So, I mean, what do you notice about the what's happened to this book? It's Sean. Yeah, she wrote in it, exactly. Or, actually, I believe her dad wrote in it. So I don't know whether you can sort of see it, but it's an acrostic. So it's for Mary Steele, who I believe is related. So I think we just have Anne Steele's... Yeah, so I think there's a connection there. But so the acrostic reads, so for Mary Steele, her name, my God, my refuge and delight, attend my humble cry. Remember, I'm a sinner great, yet thou canst for me supply. So shall I live and love and live thy praise till I resign thy breath. Eternally adore thy name, even now and after death. Lord, lead me by thy spirit still, even guide me to thy holy hill. What I especially like, though, is that at the bottom we can see, I think, Mary starting to copy out the poem herself. So you can see two lines of it written out in a slightly kind of less, I mean, it's still an incredibly elegant and beautiful hand that I'm sure no one in this room could sort of hope for, but, well, I shouldn't assume, but I couldn't. But so it's Mary writing in her book to learn perhaps how to write using the book as a sort of practice text. And actually, sort of as far back as we can go, it seems that children have written in their books. So scholars and historians who've worked on this topic, I'm thinking of Gillian Adams, Matthew Granby, and Seth Lehrer, they've shown that children sort of write a variety of things. So children might record how long it took them to read a particular volume. So they might write, you know, read 10 pages on the 11th of July, or whatever. They might write notes to or about other children, particularly in books that were used at school. So Lehrer has this really great example from the 15th century, which is that he thinks a child has written, John Ham did play with a knife on his forehead with the point. In the book, so this kind of accusation of misbehaviour from another student who was also, I think, copying out the Canterbury Tales. But actually, as we might expect, most children's marginalia, so that's what I think, you know, this is in some way, most children's marginalia is your name, so that, you know, you learn to write your name in the book as a kind of mark of ownership, obviously. And I don't know, I mean, it's obviously so significant that it makes its way into canonical Victorian literature, so Cathy Earnshaw has scrawled all over her books, writing her name and also writing a pen and ink commentary in the margins. So that's one type of children's writing, you know, at quite a small level. But I wanted to kind of counterpoint that with the children's magazine that's in the exhibition. So it's a piece of child-produced literature, I mean, I would call it. So I think the technical name for this sort of production is you know, juvenilia, and we wouldn't maybe think of that in relation to the group of children who produce this. We might think more of, you know, a famous writer's juvenilia. But I like the idea of sort of putting them, juxtaposing them with one another, I suppose. So obviously, famous juvenilia, Jane Austen. So she writes this kind of immense set of works, stories, sketches, burlesques, parodies of particular genres, little plays that perform at home. And the manuscript History of England is on the British Library's website. But what I like is that it shows her as a really adept satirist, actually, already of different styles. So in the History of England, I suppose we have this expectation that history books are going to be factual, impartial, written by people better informed than ourselves. And she has this wonderful title page, mock title page, that says, by a partial, prejudiced and ignorant historian. And then she says there'll be very few dates in this history. So the other, taking it down right away, you know, we're not going to bother with dates. So further examples of juvenilia include, or sort of prolific producers of juvenilia who became famous include the Brontes and Louisa May Alcott, who makes these kind of family magazines. But I also really like to think about writers who perhaps wrote as children but then didn't go on to write that much as adults, like Daisy Ashford, who has this kind of runaway success with her tale of social intrigue called The Young Visitors, and this is the first page of the manuscript there, which begins, "Mr. Saltina was an elderly man of 42 and was fond of asking people to stay with him." So, you know, alarm bells going off right away. He had quite a young girl staying with him of 17 named Ethel Montague, and then she gives this great description of Mr. Saltina. "Dark short hair and moustache and whiskers, which were very black and twisty, middle-sized, very pale blue eyes." So to go back to this magazine that's in the exhibition, the children, I think it's a little bit, we could sort of link it to something like what Austen's doing or what Daisy Ashford's doing. They're looking at a kind of imitation of different genres, different things you might expect to find. So again, we've got acrostics, like Mary Steele's little poem there. We've got this wonderful illustration, "Try Bovril, it is a splendid drink." And I like the way the illustration sort of mixes what we'd expect to find in a children's book, so geese, you know, lovely illustrations of landscapes and pictures with this weird kind of advertising lingo. So it almost seems to me like a kind of joke. And I really think that sources like this, so sources that are produced by children, you know, which are obviously extremely rare, can provide us with really interesting information about how children have received adult assumptions, not just sort of about society at large, but also about childhood, you know, so how do adults view children? Now, I'm showing you a picture now, and obviously one of our most famous children's heroines says, "What is the use of a book without pictures?" So I'd like to conclude the talk today before we have some questions by sort of talking a little bit about pictures. And I'm going to try to talk a little bit about sort of the different technique or appearance of pictures as they've kind of featured in children's books. So these are from the exhibition here. So this is the page from the very rare Newbery book that's on show. I kind of tried to make the picture a little bit kind of brighter so that you could see what it shows. And the one down below is actually the picture from the Child's Reward book that I showed you before. So Newbery's often identified as the first kind of proper children's publisher. And I suppose there's anecdotal evidence of his reach today in the fact that we have the Newbery Medal named after him, best children's book published in the US, published or released in the US every year as awarded the Newbery Medal. What I want to draw attention to really with these pictures is not just, it's not so much what they contain, but what they don't contain. I mean, I think with the couple at top there, what are they doing? Are they about to start dancing? Are they just going for a walk? And economically minded children's publishers would often reuse illustrations. So you see kind of often quite multi-purpose subjects being chosen as pictures for particular books. I thought the one down the bottom was a little bit like that too. That sort of feeling that we would probably have children reading in most books aimed at children. So I don't know for a fact that these are kinds of convertible illustrations, but I think there's a possibility that they might be. I suppose one of the first things that we might notice about these pictures though really is that they're not coloured. So that's a sort of pretty powerful association that we have now between children's books and books being highly coloured. I mean, I think with book publishing, you know, children's books, cookbooks and art books, really the only ones that can afford to have loads of colour in them now, you know, it's a kind of just a real genre marker. And the first way of introducing colour into children's pictures is just hand colouring. So this is an example from John Harris, who buys Newbery's firm off Elizabeth Newbery. So you can see here, this is the version of an illustration from The Butterfly's Ball, uncoloured, version coloured. Some of you might know the phrase, I believe it's a penny plain, tuppence coloured. So this idea that works are priced differently depending on whether they have been hand-coloured or not. But even the hand-coloured ones are pretty expensive. So I'm assuming, and I think lots of people assume, that you might buy it uncoloured and colour it yourself as well. So take it home and sort of DIY. But obviously the history of children's literature is kind of entwined with the development of different sorts of colour printing. So just to sort of throw a few up here, the first colour printed picture that's known in England is the frontispiece to one of Mrs. Sherwood's children's books, two of them actually, Social Tales for the Young and Caroline Mauzon. So it's the Baxter process of colour printing. Later in the century, we have these beautiful kind of coloured wood engravings like this one in a Walter Crane picture book. And then we have chromolithography as well, and the kind of rise actually of a kind of Anglo-German market or production of children's books because of fine lithographic stone available in Nuremberg. And then later, obviously, Beatrix Potter recognises the importance of colour and of colour printing. She insists on this kind of quite expensive process for producing her little books at the start of the 20th century, three colour half tone. So, I mean, that really is partly an excuse to show you lots of, I hope, beautiful pictures. But from Keach and Newbery, these things that might seem to be quite distant from examples like this, and certainly from what we see today, we have that tendency to sort of see the history of children's literature as the history of illustration as well. So both instructional books and books that kind of have less of an explicit instructional intention rely on pictures for their appeal. So as I said at the beginning, it's such a huge topic, I think it's quite difficult to get to everything. But I wanted to conclude by saying a little bit about, I think, the importance of a library or collection like the one here for the study of children's literature. So because children's books have been, obviously, a traditionally kind of marginal domain within publishing, they're often not well represented in certain libraries. So, for example, the Bodleian in 1818 rejects a bunch of children's books that it's received through legal deposit. It says, no, we don't want these on our shelves. We're sort of essentially setting them back or getting rid of them. So even when we might assume books, as libraries would have a kind of very comprehensive coverage of all the children's literature that's been published, they often don't because they didn't think it was worth getting. And then there's the fact that children's books are often much loved by their owners. So that sense that you have when handling archival material, when even looking at these things here, of books that have sort of been loved to death, this is Seth Lehrer's phrase, the fact that they're sort of falling apart at the seams, it means that this kind of evidence that we have in front of us today of what children read, and particularly from the earlier part of the period covered in the exhibition, is, I think, immensely valuable. So to conclude, I think in this display of books, we can see a number of trends that kind of characterise children's literature over the whole period on display. So obviously we've got the moral, the didactic, the tendency of children's literature towards giving particular lessons. We've got the use of devices like the dialogue or the kind of moral tale to convey religious and moral lessons. And also I think the role of pictures and images to the delight that children's books promise, as well as to the instruction. And then I think, perhaps most unusually, we have evidence of children using their books. So what have they done with them once they've actually sort of got them? And that includes the kind of writing of your own books, I think. Thank you. Thank you.